From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with Vermont author Nancy Hayes Kilgore, whose novel Bitter Magic has just come out from Sunbury. Nancy Hayes Kilgore is the author of two other novels, Wild Mountain, about which we spoke in 2017, I believe was the date, and Sea Level. Her writing has won the Vermont Writers Prize and a Forward Reviews Book of the Year Award. She has published in a She Writes Press anthology titled Times They Were a Changin', Women Remember the 60s and 70s. And she's also written for Bloodroot Literary Magazine, Vermont Magazine, The Bottle Imp, and on Vermont Public Radio. Nancy is a graduate of the Radcliffe Writing Seminars and holds a Master of Divinity degree and a doctorate in pastoral counseling. She's a writing coach, psychotherapist, and former parish pastor, and leads workshops on creative writing and spirituality. She lives with her husband, dog, and cat in Vermont. Her new novel, Bitter Magic, is inspired by the true story of Isabel Gowdy and her witchcraft confession, which revealed a little-known corner of history, the lives of both pagan and Protestant women in the Reformation of the 1600s, as witch trials and executions threatened their lives, values, and beliefs. Here's a little summary of the book. When Margaret Hay, a fictionalized 17-year-old noblewoman, stumbles across Isabel one day, it seems as though Isabel is commanding the dolphins in the ocean to dance. Margaret is enchanted. She becomes interested in Isabel's magic, in fairies, and in herbal remedies. Isabel freely shares her knowledge. While Margaret worries that being around Isabel could be dangerous, she also respects Isabel's medical successes and comes to believe that acknowledging the efficacy of herbal remedies or believing in fairies does not challenge her Christianity. But Isabel believes in more than cheery fairies and herbal medicine. She has dark wishes as well, unknown to most people. She seeks vengeance against the local lord who executed her mother for witchcraft. More importantly, Isabel's trance experiences, or are they dreams, lead her to confess to a wide range of sins, including consorting with the devil. Then, during her trial, Isabel names 13 others, calling them all witches. To her great shock, Margaret hears her own name. Can her tutor, a Christian mystic named Catherine, save them? My interview with Nancy Hayes Kilgore begins with the author reading from her opening chapter. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Aldering, Scotland, 1660, Chapter 1. The wind blustered and Margaret pulled her cape tighter, walking briskly past the fields of flax, past the loch, and across the dunes. She scrambled down the path, slipping on the scree as pebbles tumbled down the duneside. Landing on her feet, she walked toward the sea. Alone in this wide land, Margaret thought, except for the gulls that swooped and shrieked above. And in the distance, a figure, gray and brown, against the sandbar. The woman's dress blew around her as she bent and raked. She was plucking cockles and placing them in a basket. Steady motions, bending and raking and plucking, in tune with the rhythm of the waves and the tide. Just a barefoot peasant like generations before her and those to come after. People harvesting from the sea and blending with its melodies. But there was something else about this woman, a dignity or a self-possession, an unusual stillness as if she were a world in and of herself. The sea churned and two dark humps rose and fell in the green water. Dolphins. The gray-brown woman faced the sea and raised her arms as if beckoning to them. Margaret hesitated, then walked across the sandbar as the woman straightened and looked back at her. The hood of her plaid flapped in the wind, hiding then revealing light eyes and a pale face. Her look was both open and inscrutable. She stared at Margaret and nodded, almost as if she had been expecting her. Suddenly, Margaret stumbled, confused. Though she was just 17, the peasants usually bowed or curtsied when they saw her. But this woman did not. Perhaps she should have been insulted, but instead she was curious. Who was this? The woman lifted her arms, swinging them back and forth as if conducting an orchestra. The dolphins jumped and flipped in the air. Could they be following her commands? One had a scar on its cheek and the other a dark spot on its back. These were the two dolphins that were here so often, showing off and commanding attention like children. Margaret had always felt that they knew her. Did they know this woman too? Margaret clapped her hands, as she always did at their performance, so as not to let them down. Excellent, she shouted. The woman peered at her again. She was younger than Margaret had thought, perhaps closer to 30, and now she looked familiar, one of the farm town women. Her face was marked by the pox, and her fixed stare shifted as the corners of her mouth curved up. Light seemed to shimmer around her body. Titania, an Oberon, cried Margaret. The woman furrowed her brows. What say ye, mistress? Those are the names I've given them, after the fairy queen and king. The dolphins jumped again and dived beneath the surface. The fairies, you say, said the woman. Yes, in Mr. Shakespeare's play. It had been something she wasn't supposed to read, but when she'd found the volume containing A Midsummer Night's Dream in Aunt Grizel's library, she'd begged and begged until she was allowed to read it. When Margaret opened the book, she found herself stepping into another world, a world where fairies danced and frolicked. The dolphins came close, smiling and raising their soft snouts out of the water. They seemed to recognize Margaret, too, and she called their names again. Oberon, Titania. Now there were two or three more, and they cavorted and jumped in the water. Mr. Shakespeare's been to Elphane, the woman said, but you need not travel to London to find it. It was as if she knew Margaret's thoughts and her longing to go to London, now that the ban on theater was lifted, to see a real play. Elphane, Margaret said, the fairy kingdom. The fairy kingdom. Mr. Harry preached about this belief in fairies, this superstition of the devil to keep the people ignorant and away from God. The woman turned again, flicked her wrist, and called out a rhyme. Go with the fisheries gone to sea, and bring home mickle fish to me. Bring the mickle fish to me. Go out with the fisheries gone to sea. In the name of the Trinity Three, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. In the name of St. Andrew and Trinity Three, bring the mickle fish to me. The dolphins dived and disappeared. Margaret gaped. Did they understand you? Aye, mistress, and they'll do my bidding. I'll have a good harvest when the boats come in. How did you learn to talk with the dolphins? The woman looked around and lowered her voice. Nay, 'tis not to say. The woman launched into Gaelic now. Though Margaret spoke it a little, this was too fast for her. There was one word she understood, she or fairies. Was this magic? Margaret felt her legs shaking and looked around to make sure her family was not watching, even though she knew they were far away in the castle. If they could see her now talking about fairies, or if, God forbid, Mr. Harry, the minister, was about. She shuddered, but forced herself to stand firm. Have you seen the fairies? She asked. I have an da shayla, mistress. What? The two sights. Second sight. I see the other world, the place of the spirits, where be the fairies. Margaret's eyes widened. The other world? According to Mr. Harry, fairies were devils, and people who associated with them were evil. She had never heard about this other world, here on Earth, where fairies lived. What did it mean? Was it like in A Midsummer Night's Dream? The woman bowed her head in assent. Veiled but piercing eyes looked up at Margaret. And where be the dead? She said. The dead? Margaret shivered. The wind had picked up and the woman wrapped her plaid around her shoulders. I must go now. But Margaret wanted to ask, how and when? But she was sore afraid and the words stuck in her throat. Without another word, the woman of second sight turned and started back along the strand. Margaret could only watch as she walked away, her body small and graceful beneath her garments.
Thank you for reading that. That's a wonderful opening chapter, and it's so engaging, and it brings in so much that will become important later. I loved the very quick way that you establish both of these women, really, but Margaret's character and situation is very subtly available to us right from the start. You know, she quotes alone in this wide land, but she really is, you know, very much a part. She's looked upon with reverence by the townspeople, and they curtsy to her and fawn. And so she's sort of drawn to this woman who doesn't behave that way. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the history upon which this book is based and how you found out about it and which of the characters were really presented to you in research and which did you have to really kind of most expand upon?
Yes. Well, Isabel Gowdy was a real person, and she in 1662 confessed to witchcraft. The details surrounding her confession are not really known too well, but as far as the scholars could figure out, she was not tortured to confess, and her confession was a very almost whimsical, elaborate story about her life with the fairies and her healing gifts and her magic, which she used in various ways. So I discovered her story, and then it was in the heart of the Covenanter country, and Covenanters were the very strict Presbyterians who had basically instigated the Scottish Reformation. But it turns out that where they were most populous were the most witch trials in that witch craze time, the 17th century. And there I found Isabel's story. So I was intrigued, and I wanted to look at the conflict. This was a time of great change in the culture, and a time when Protestants were taking over Scotland. Well, they had already taken over Scotland. They had, tried to destroy the Catholics. But they were still fighting the English, and they were fighting the Royalists, and still struggling to get dominance. But at the same time, there was this old culture, this traditional culture of herbalists and cunning women, and which Isabel represented. So yeah. I was intrigued by that juxtaposition between those two cultures.
And this is early 17th century, so there's actually quite a lot of historical record that you could draw on. And I noticed at the end of the book, you mention that almost all of your characters are based on real people, although you change some names, and sometimes you didn't know what had happened to them, and you kind of created a path for them. So was Margaret also a real character?
Well, Margaret was the daughter of the laird on whose estate Isabel lived, and this laird did actually have two daughters, but we don't know anything about them. So I just took a lot of liberty with Margaret.
Yeah.
And she became really the protagonist.
And you named her, right? You didn't know what her name was either. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what I wanted to mention is that I very much admire the way that you open this book in a way that lets us very quickly, even before there's any interaction between the women, we understand certain things about them. And I think that's hard to do, and you did it very subtly. So one thing was her thinking of the line, alone in this wide land. And she is sort of alone in the world in some ways. She does have a best friend, and she has a family, but she's set apart from the townspeople nearby because of her wealth and status. And they sort of curtsy to her, and it's clear from the start that she's a little bit of a loner, and that she's maybe ready for something different. You know, she's looking for something to do. She goes for her walks by herself on the beach.
Yeah, she's curious.
Yes.
And she's curious about life and the meaning of life and you know, what's beyond this very conservative world that she's grown up in, you know, this very restricted religious life. You know, what else is out there? And of course, Isabel, this mysterious woman,
right,
is pretty intriguing.
She is, and she's right at home, whereas Margaret, who would like to go to London and see other things and go to a Shakespeare play, is being told, no, 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 you can't step out into the world. You're only 17, which doesn't give her a lot of options for finding adventure. So I thought that was interesting. And then Isabel, I loved this, and I wondered if this was purposeful. I assume it was, but she's immediately painted as a figure, gray and brown. And I thought those colors make her very organic to the landscape. And to me, that sort of like right away established her as more one with nature than necessarily one of society. And I don't know if you meant to do that, but that's how it kind of came across to me. She's part of the landscape before she kind of, you know, materializes and becomes something separate as Margaret approaches her. So do you remember writing that opening? And was that sort of something you did early in the process of writing the book? Or did you start there? I mean, or did you come back and circle back and write the opening later?
Well, this wasn't originally the opening, and you know, because you're a writer,
right?
How many times you can change an opening,
right?
A first chapter, which I did quite a bit. So, originally the first chapter was started with Isabel, and, you know, and then I had some really good feedback, you know, and I went to workshops and things, and, it was pointed out that Margaret was really the protagonist. So starting with this meeting between them seemed like the appropriate place to start.
Okay, wonderful. Now, one thing that you did, you know, you established sort of some of the things that are going on at the time, but you don't go right into great detail about them. So you drop in the pox, you know, and we kind of know, oh, okay, so that's this period of time. We sort of know that because of Shakespeare, but, you know, if nobody kind of puts that together, the pox kind of explains what things are like back then. And then thinking about the pox made me wonder if the pandemic affected this part of the story as you were writing it. And if you went back and revised parts based on, you know, what you saw unfolding with COVID.
Well, that's an interesting question. No.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I wrote this originally, you know, so far before the pandemic. I didn't think about it afterwards either, but yeah, I mean, that was the plague had just happened, I don't know, 20 years before, and a lot of people died of that. And of course, the pox, the smallpox was a big epidemic then, too.
Right. Yeah. Okay. How much did the sort of people of the countryside know about Shakespeare? I don't know that much about that. Was that something that she knew about because of her status and her position in the town, or would that have been widely known by everybody?
Well, I just think Margaret knew because she was educated, even though she wasn't supposed to be reading anything but religious literature.
Right.
But her, you know, the people around her aunt and her aunt's father, who was the main powerful laird in the region, they were much more educated and more, I wouldn't say liberal, but they were a lot more expansive in their knowledge than most of the gentry, actually, who were trying to kind of be a lot more narrow.
Yeah. Let's see. I wanted to ask you about Mr. Harry. The mention of Mr. Harry in this early scene sort of introduces kind of built-in conflict early on, because right away we're introduced to the idea of magic and a witch, whether or not she's good or bad, and then that society frowns on this, and especially this religious leader in the town frowns on this very, very fervently. So I wondered how you came to write Mr. Harry. He was based on a real person too.
He was definitely based on a real person, and he was a witch hunter. And he was, you know, eventually trying to get Isabel, and was one of the principal people in bringing her to trial.
Right.
And so he represented this well, almost stereotypical, you know, witch hunter that we read about. But also I tried to portray him. And it's hard. I tried to be sympathetic with all the characters, and he was a little hard to be sympathetic with, but I studied the theology of the ministers of that time, and as well as I could, and figure out, you know, what did they really believe? And so I think I got some of Mr. Harry later on in his fervent, you know, belief and his sense of mission, even though it was misguided and distorted when it came to the witches.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you if you tried to understand his fears as you worked, because it came through to me that you were sort of at least understanding him, if not aligning yourself with him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you also have a character who's the devil, essentially. So did you try to understand that character?
Well, that came straight from Isabel's real confession.
Okay.
Her description of the devil. And so I pretty much put that in her words and language in the book. And I didn't really try to go farther than that.
Now, you have a religious education. You've worked as a parish pastor, I believe. Have you run into, in your work, have you run into a kind of religious fervor element, an element of people that are just very much hard on anybody who doesn't believe what they believe? Do you run across a lot of that still in our present day?
Yeah. Well, I can't say really in the churches that I was part of that's true, because I was really in more liberal kinds of churches. And, you know, you're talking about a real sort of narrow fundamentalist outlook, which is pretty scary.
Yeah.
And the scary thing about it is it's so prevalent now and so based on misinformation. And one of the hard things about it for me is that people characterize Christians that way, you know, and there's so many Christians who are not like judgmental and narrow and restricted like that. So,
Early on, I don't know that it was in the section that you read, but early on, there's a mention that Margaret's family has a little son, Wee John. And you write, no one expects Wee John to live. And you left that as sort of unexplained at first. And I wondered, you know, like dropping in a little piece of information. Do you do that because the character wouldn't necessarily be following all the threads because she already knows what's going on there? Or do you do that as a suspenseful tactic?
Well, actually, I had a chapter about Wee John that was more embodying him, but I took it out.
Oh, okay.
but it was, I think it was more to show, you know, the difficulty of child rearing and childbirth, you know, and how many babies and children died in that era.
I wonder if you can talk about the historical research that you did and how you approached figuring out who all of these people were and what you wanted to keep and what you wanted to change.
Yeah, well, this was my first historical novel, and so this was a challenge. Exactly what you're saying was the challenge. What do you keep? And I spent a long time researching it and trying to think of, what did these people believe, really, you know, what were they like and what did they really believe? And in some ways it felt like such a remote time and place that it was a little hard to get into it, but I kept working at it. And the internet and books a lot for the first couple of years. And then I took a trip to Scotland.
Oh.
And, you know, I'd already written, I forget, one or two drafts. But when I was there, it was great just being in that place where Isabel lived. And I actually, I had written to someone who lived in the Loch Loy house. Loch Loy was the little area where Isabel lived. It's where the farm town was. And he invited me to come stay in his guest house.
Oh, wow.
And so it was so exciting. I got to stay right there where Isabel lived and walk around and see the different places where she went. And the most exciting part was finding the fairy mound. And this is called the Downy Hill. And it was way off and not marked by any, you know, signs, and people didn't even know where it was, the neighbors. But using the Orient Survey map, I found it and climbed up on the Downy Hill.
Did the neighbors all know her story?
No.
Wow.
I mean, not those immediate neighbors. I mean, there were people in the town who know the story. No, and she's called the Witch of Aldern. Aldern was the town. But yeah, it was a real adventure. I went with my new friend Morag, who was I stayed with at the Airbnb, and she got excited about this story too. So we trekked off in her little car to find the Downy Hill, and we finally found it covered with woods and bracken, and then we climbed up, and I thought, oh, this is where Isabel met the fairies. This is where she said the hill opened and the fairy queen lived in there along with elves, and she communicated with them, and she went with them flying off into the nether worlds.
Yeah.
In her out of body experiences.
That's wonderful.
That's how I explained it. They were out of body experiences.
Yeah. Now, as you wrote those scenes about the fairies and Isabel's point of view, was that fun? And did you kind of like go along with those thoughts and those scenes and those fantasies to kind of like get into the whole thing?
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. I mean, you know, fairies, a lot of us have grown up with sort of magical ideas about fairies. And, you know, my granddaughter went through a real fairy phase where she was making fairy houses all over the yard and for the fairies to come. But yeah, so I think it's an enchanting thing, and it was fun to get into, you know, imagining what was Isabel. I mean, she did talk about this directly in her confession about how she flew with the fairies and went into the biggest castle in the land and feasted on everything that was in the larder with her group of people.
That's fun. So, did you, as you climbed up that hill, did you have any like feelings that maybe there was going to be some sort of epiphany up there for you?
Yeah, it was a really exciting thing, a sense of mystery. I mean, when you're there, actually, it's, you know, it was pretty overgrown with ferns and bracken, and we had to push our way through, and it was like a real trek, you know, a hike. But at the top, we found a clearing. It was a beautiful sunny day, and we just stood there, and I didn't see any fairies, but it was a very sudden sense of quiet and peacefulness there.
Hmm.
So it did really feel like a sacred spot.
So other than the record of her confession, are there records of Isabel as far as, I don't know what she did? Some of, like, you have her actual, I don't know. You have some sort of charms and spells in here. Did you make that up, or were those things you ran across in your research?
Yeah, she did recite them in her confession.
Oh, she did.
Those charms, yeah. I mean, the one that I just read from the beginning was sort of a composite. She actually didn't say anything about dolphins, but she would say things like she turned herself into a hare or a crow, and a cat.
Now, there's a character named Henrietta. And Henrietta is Margaret's best friend. And it's funny because I knew right away that Henrietta would be an important character when I started reading. But it I'm not going to say what I thought would happen or what did happen, but it wasn't exactly what I expected. But it was interesting to see you set up this friendship at the very start with Margaret trusting Henrietta with a somewhat dangerous secret. And I thought that established some real nice tension and suspense. And especially given her quick reaction, which wasn't exactly encouraging. I mean, right away, her reaction is a bit of fear and a bit of awe that Margaret might be, spending time with a witch. So do you want to talk a little bit about writing her character?
Yeah, Henrietta was also a fun character to write and to write about. And she represented not only Margaret's friend, but, you know, I won't give it away, but she came in later for a very dramatic twist in the plot.
Correct.
And then Isabel had to be, you know, summoned and used her magic to help out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that Henrietta says when Margaret tells her about having met Isabel out on the beach is, Dunlop was burned for witchcraft just last month. And I wanted to actually ask you a craft question about this, and that is including information that the reader will find valuable through dialogue. That whole scene actually between Margaret and Henrietta is a really good way, apart from Margaret's understanding of what Mr. Harry would think about meeting Isabel on the beach like that. That scene really kind of establishes the fear and danger that's around spending time with the magic people or the witches. And so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about including information by dialogue.
Yeah, I think it works better than just writing it, you know, saying, because actually Agnes Dunlop was a real person too, and she was burned at the stake for witchcraft. But yeah, placing it in that town, in the town of Nairn where Henrietta lived, and having Henrietta talk about it, I think it showed the contrast in a sense between Henrietta and Margaret, that Henrietta was a lot more cautious and Margaret was a little bit reckless in her adventurousness.
Yeah, yeah. As you worked on this book, there are, again, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but there are crimes against women in this book, I'll say. Did you find it turning to somewhat of a feminist plot for you as you worked, whether or not you intended it to be that way?
Yeah, and I think that I originally came into it with a feminist
Oh, you did.
Perspective.
Yeah.
Because, you know, which you know, and I tried to get beyond that in a sense to get a little deeper, because I think that's our typical, you know, understanding of that era, you know, that the women were being oppressed, and this was, you know, patriarchy run amok. And so I was trying to, you know, get a sense of more depth and more of all of this history here, and more looking at the nuances and different sides of it.
Sure, that makes sense. I mean, it's funny because when I thought of that question, I was mainly thinking, okay, so you came into this historical, you know, novel with an actual story, but of course, what probably inspired you about that story was to some extent also the powerlessness of the women and the way that they might try to find power through their
right.
through their work, through midwifery, through being herbalists and all the things that, you know, medical careers, for example, that weren't available to them in any other sense.
Exactly. And those women, you know, were powerful in their community. They did have status and they were leaders. And this is exactly what the Protestant Reformation, one side of the Protestant Reformation, was trying to eliminate. You know, and it really, you know, male power was really taking over then, mm-hmm. you know, because the women and the earth-based spirituality had been pretty dominant, you know, for, I guess, centuries.
Centuries, right. Yeah, I just read something the other day about the Catholic Pope Innocence. His name was Pope Innocence. He was horrible, and he would burn women at the stake for very similar supposed crimes, and horrible. Let's talk a little bit about writing this story from multiple points of view. So you said that you almost started with Isabel, and then on the advice of some trusted writing friends, you decided that you should start with Margaret. How many points of view did you ever experiment with before getting to what you would eventually establish as the points of view of this story?
Well, Harry does come in, and his point of view comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And also Catherine. I mean, the two main points of view are Margaret and Isabel. And it switched back and forth between those. But there's also two other main characters. And one is Harry, the minister, and the other is Catherine Collis, who was Margaret's tutor and also a Christian mystic. And she was also a real person. Mm-hmm. And I actually had her diary to go from.
Oh, wow.
So I wanted to bring in her perspective at various times to get that way of seeing Margaret from an adult point of view, and from a very earnest Christian woman, you know, who was also very compassionate.
Right. Okay. Did you ever experiment with a point of view that didn't end up making it in?
Probably. I can't remember.
I'm thinking about the woman who lives in the house, Bessie?
Oh, Bessie Wilson.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever give her a point of view or?
No.
No?
No,
okay.
I didn't. But there was a person named Bessie Wilson. I played with the names, you know, that a lot of those names were real names, but she was actually one of the, Bessie Wilson in reality was someone that Isabel named as part of her coven.
Oh, okay. All right, great. Let's see. I always like to ask people what they've read lately that they might recommend to listeners. Have you read any books that you would particularly recommend?
Oh, yes, a lot. I'm just reading now a book called An Irish Wife by Deborah Lincoln. And it's based on her family history, the Lincoln family in Pennsylvania. Very interesting. And I also just finished The Midnight Library by Matt Haig. Maybe you know that, but it's wonderful.
I haven't read it, but I have heard of it.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's kind of existential, unusual kind of story that really, really brings you in.
Okay, wonderful. And what are you working on next? Do you know what you're, are you writing something new?
Well, I've been sort of off and on. I'm sort of on hold now, but I've been working on a story about my grandmother.
Uh-huh.
Who was, or not about her, but based on her, who was a suffragist in the early part of the 20th century. But she also had tuberculosis, and she lived in a sanatorium.
Oh, okay.
And she actually died when my mother was born.
Oh.
So my mother grew up not knowing her, and I grew up not knowing her, but we had all these legends about her. Then I discovered a whole trove of her letters.
I was going to say, was there any sort of archive?
Yeah, in her 20s, which changed the picture of her drastically that I had grown up with. So it was fun.
Oh, that's great. Do you feel like it gave you a more well-rounded view of who she was? Or is there some disconnect where you're like, how did this person end up becoming this person?
Yes. It made her much more real and lively and interesting.
Oh, cool. So you're thinking you might write fiction about her, or a family memoir type of thing, or?
Yeah, so, maybe a combination.
Yeah, right. Okay, great. So, Nancy, I always like to finish my interviews by asking for advice for other writers. And in your case, I thought I might ask, anybody's always welcome to give advice that isn't related to my question, if you have specific advice that you think would be good. But I was going to ask you about advice for choosing a story path when you're dealing with historical information, like, you know, choosing a path that allows for creativity, even though the history is on the page already. And so where do you decide to put in your mark?
Right. Right. And I think you pinpointed that's I think the biggest challenge in writing historical fiction is how much do you try to stay to the real story and how much you can't really stay to the real story because it's really sort of dull and boring. So yeah, I mean, this story actually wasn't dull and boring, but there wasn't really a story there. So just trying to get into the consciousness of these people, and of course, you know, you're using your own imagination, and it's not necessarily what they were thinking, but you're kind of trying to put yourself in their shoes, and just imagine what would she have thought, what would she have felt. How would he have done this or that? And just, you know, letting it sort of flow without trying too hard to make it perfectly accurate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, wonderful. Okay, well, I want to mention again, the name of the novel is Bitter Magic by Nancy Hayes Kilgore, who's been my guest on the show today, and it's published by Sunbury Press. So, Nancy, thank you so much for speaking with me again.
Thank you, Shayla. Yes, likewise.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. And this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Nancy Hayes Kilgore, and you can learn more about her work at nancykilgore.com. We did speak once before, as I mentioned. You can find that interview on the podcast site. We talked about her book, Wild Mountain. And then, actually, as part of that interview, I read a paragraph and asked her about it. And later, she did me the great honor of asking if I'd be interested in reading the audio book of Wild Mountain. And I was curious to do that. So we went ahead and did it. So if you check out the audio book of Wild Mountain, it is Nancy Kilgore's book, and it is my voice. And you can get that, I think, in your local library as well as lots of other places. Okay, as we mentioned during our interview, one character who Nancy Hayes Kilgore describes in Bitter Magic is the devil himself. He appears to Isabel Gowdy in a spot where a tree had stood only moments before, and she depicts him as a blonde man wearing green, but then during their encounter, he changes, which was a kind of exciting moment in the book and gave me shivers. Anyway, this week's Write the Book prompt is to write a character based on a famous non-human entity, such as a leprechaun, a fairy, a centaur, a cherub, a poltergeist, a ghost. Consider what you feel to be accurate about how this entity has been depicted historically and how you might change that depiction. Will you use this character in your work without naming who or what it's based on, or will you leave that to readers to identify? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Although I say this every week, I'm going to say it again. Vermont looks pretty good. I mean, we've been really getting vaccinated. We're at, I think, over 85% vaccinated now, and that's exciting, but the pandemic is not over. It's clear that even if you've been vaccinated, it's possible to pick up the disease and pass along to others. So just bear that in mind as you go through your days, and try to be healthy and well and keep other people healthy and well. I hope that you are able to read and to write, to find your favorite authors, and to follow them. Perhaps they're having launches and book tours that, like that Northshire calendar this week. A lot of them are virtual. Authors need our support. We need each other's support. So try to support the authors whose books are coming out. Look out for their events and try to attend or support them in some way. For all of you who are trying to write these days, check the archives of Write the Book. Each episode offers a writing prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I don't know how many writing prompts I have at this point, but it's something like close to 600 and something, maybe. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know how you feel about it, and if you have certain authors you'd like to see me interview. And also, if you are an author or you know an author and there are events to announce, you can let me know what those are. And each week I do announce events if I have time for the coming week. So be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, all kinds of podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and like it and talk about it on social media and stuff like that. Thank you. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.